Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that will always toss a coin to your Witcher. Today we're talking about Disco Elysium, a wonderful RPG that Kirk and Maddie are still playing. We also dig a bit into Hollow Knight and Monster Hunter World Iceborne before checking in on some quick news. Then we open up the listener mailbag to answer some questions about our most difficult gaming accomplishments, the games we would hypothetically speedrun, and whether Xbox might ever make a living room PC. Finally, we talk about James Cameron, Parasite, and the glorious return of NFL playoffs. Stories. Let's go! And we are back for another episode. My name is Jason Schreier, and I'm joined once again by Maddie Myers.
Hello, it's me.
And Kirk Hamilton.
Hello, it's me too.
Maddie, Kirk, I have a little bit of news before we start. I am going on the second half of my paternity leave and will be gone for the next 4 weeks once again. So you guys will have to manage without me somehow.
What if you were announcing it to us on the show right now? Like, what if we also didn't know this
information?
We didn't know.
We're like, whoa, what?
Idea. What?
You're going to be gone for 4 weeks?
Yeah, oh, okay.
What are you going to do?
You'd be like,
just
oh my
kidding.
God,
we know
we
about
do?
It. We do.
So I'm sure you guys are going to plan all sorts of fun activities and guests and superstars while I'm gone. So
we will. Sure. We will miss you, though, because as always, the show is never the same without you.
It's true.
I have to finish a book, so I will hopefully,
good luck.
Hopefully be able to do that in the next 4 weeks.
I think you can. I believe in you.
And before we start talking about video games, Kirk, is there something that you had to, correction from you?
It's not a correction, it's a clarification.
That
we received this from several listeners via email and tweet. As always, remember, you can email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com. We were talking, I think this is on our Games of 2019, we were talking about daggers and knives, mm-hmm. the difference between the two.
Is there one?
There is. There are a couple. Well, there's really just one. So basically, a dagger has a sharp edge on both sides of the blade, and a knife has a sharp edge only on one. And a dagger is meant for stabbing people and killing people, and a knife is basically meant for, you know, chopping things. I guess you can have like a pocket knife, but it's more of a utility item. And then also a few people pointed out that a dagger does 1d4 damage in D&D. I believe I said 1d8 off the top of my head.
Oh,
which way
so
too
that
high.
Was way, way off.
Way high. Daggers only do 1d4, plus I think whatever modifier. So you could have like a dagger plus one, you know, vorpal dagger. Can you have a vorpal dagger? I don't know. Now we're going to get a bunch more corrections. Split screen
and
at Kotaku.com.
We're going to love getting them.
Tell us about vorpal
Send
blades, please.
Great.
Good to know. 1d4 versus 1d8. Important differences here. Yeah. Okay, cool. So with that bombshell out of the way, why don't we talk about some video games that we are playing?
Let's do it.
Let's start with Maddie Myers. Maddie, why don't you go first?
Sure. So I really wanted to beat Disco Elysium before we recorded this, but I just haven't made it, guys. And I blame myself for
That's
talking
fine.
To too
it's
many
a long
characters
ass game.
And
yeah,
enjoying
it, really,
it too much.
It opens
too
up
much
in the
fun.
Middle there, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm
so
in the fishing village.
How far are you?
I'm in the fishing village. I think I'm on day 4. Okay, so part of why it's taking me so long is because I played all of day 2 and then realized that a thing that I had done fairly early on in day 2 was causing a lot of problems for me that I wasn't going to be able to get around and that I needed to go back and redo it. So I redid all of day 2.
Yeah, I think you can say what it was. What was it?
I guess so. I guess I can spoil it. So At a certain point in the game, you have to question this guy whose name is, I think, Titus, and you have to prove your authority to him. Mm-hmm. And there are a few different ways you can go about it. I have, like, almost no authority points at all. Like, I just don't. I have no authority. I'm playing as an empathetic empathy man.
Yes, yes.
And I have nothing. I don't believe in being a cop, and all of my answers show that.
Unlike real life, in which you have been promoted to deputy editor and now have tons
and
of authority.
And yet, all one empathy, could argue I'm still an empathetic empathy man.
True.
Even in my actual job.
They're equally important, I think.
Yes, very true. I listen to everyone and I talk to everyone.
In real life, you've mastered all of the skills.
Of course, right. Especially the physical ones. So anyway, the point is I have no authority points and you have to have them in order to talk to this guy. And you can get more authority or you can get like a boost if you fail mm-hmm. that initial check by going and talking to the union boss guy who's like this slimy guy who you have to deal with even though he's kind of awful. Everyone in the game is kind of awful on some
he's,
level.
He's
that
tough
kind of
though.
Game.
The union dude is tough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if you talk to him, he'll kind of be like, okay, I'll put in a good word for you. And then that gives you like plus 10 to authority mm-hmm. or something. And so I circled back around to the guy. Somehow I still failed that check again. And if you fail that one, I don't think there's another way that you can get that guy
really?
To talk to you, or at least not one that I could find. But I was like, oh, well, it's fine. Like in every other, like with Measurehead, I had a similar set of problems where like mm-hmm. I somehow failed like every single thing that you do to get past that guy. Like I failed the physical check with the guy. Like mm-hmm. I couldn't beat him up, which was fine. I didn't have that many stats in that. So then I was like, okay, great. I guess I have to learn this guy's racist ideology because Measurehead as a character is a racist. And like one mm-hmm. way you can get past him is by agreeing to think about his ideology in your head for long enough that you like can talk to him about it. So I was like, oh, this sucks. I'm going to have to fucking learn this. So I like put that in my head and then walked around town, did other stuff. Came back to the guy, tried to talk to him about it. Somehow that also didn't work. Like it turns out that like you can still fuck that up, probably because I just wasn't willing to be racist enough or something. So I just like selected the wrong dialogue options, still couldn't get past the guy. But then in that scenario, you can go to the union boss and he will help you out and like give you a way to get past him. So I was like, this Titus guy is going to be the same deal. Like, I'm just going to keep going around town, doing quests, doing stuff. And eventually it's going to be obvious how I get past this guy. But it's not because you can't, if you don't get past that check, I think her name's Klaja, the woman who lives
lawyer.
In the... The woman who he describes.
The
woman upstairs who you have to interrogate in order to mm-hmm. like get to the next significant plot element of the game. She just wouldn't appear, like no matter what I did. And so like eventually I was looking up walkthroughs. I was like, how do I get past Titus? And it was like, well, just go talk to Klaja and you'll figure it out. And I'm like, she's not even here, man. And so I had to like redo all of day two and it was great. I redid everything. I would recommend not failing that authority check because it's a lot more important than you think it is.
Interesting.
And the second time I just like save scummed until I passed it. And there might be a better way to do it that I just don't know. I'm loving this game so much.
Well, you can
but
also
I feel
just
like
do other stuff and get points and then try it.
Yeah, that's
again.
What I was like, I could grind for authority and then try it again mm-hmm. or whatever, but I just was like, fuck it, I'm gonna redo everything again. And the second time I did day two, it went way better because I knew everything. And so I was like acing day two and I was like, I already know every single thing I need to do. I'm a super cop now, and that felt really good. So like,
nice.
I don't know.
Good work, super cop.
You're right though, that I probably should have just put more points in authority because you can retry a check by doing that.
Right.
But I don't think I realized that until
that.
Several
you can
hours
put
later.
Put in a point, retry it. If you
exactly.
fail, then put in another point. So it wound up being this whole thing towards the end of the game as I was playing, because I beat the game. Towards the end, I wound up just hoarding points and only using them to
I've started doing that too.
Things.
Yeah.
And then also you'll wind up with this inventory full of equipment. And I also wound up scumming it. So I just like put on the best equipment after talking to someone, seeing what the skill check would be, and then putting on whatever relevant equipment would modify my stats to enhance that skill check.
I think that's kind of what you're supposed to do. Go ahead, Kirk.
I think, it gets a little gamey. The map I've found is helpful because it gives you all the checks that are currently waiting for you, which is something that I had never really checked, but is useful because there's a lot. There are some that I didn't realize. Like Kim has one, my partner, that I had just never done. I always save a few points just in case I need to
I should have done that more.
Let me ask you, Maddie, because this is one of my games too, so I figure we can just talk about it now. I've been playing it again too.
Oh, great. I'm so excited for you both to finish.
Yeah, it's great. It really, it feels like it really bulges in the middle. And then I'm guessing from what you've said, like it tapers off toward the end. Mm-hmm. And I'm in, I think, Thursday, and it is bulgy. Like I come back to it and I was like, Jesus, there's so much stuff to do. There are a couple of times where I'll have a quest. One of them is examining gunshot residue, like trying to find where a shot came from. And you can't do some of them. I had to Google this because I was like, there's like, you're supposed to go to the boardwalk and find.
Yeah, you can't finish that until the very end.
Hopefully, maybe this is helpful, Maddie, if you haven't done this yet. But like, you're supposed to check three places for gunshot residue. This isn't a big spoiler or anything. And one of them is on the boardwalk and you just can't do it until later. And I was like walking around the boardwalk forever looking for it. And it doesn't, sometimes it'll say, you know,
you're not going to be able to do this until later. Boardwalk you haven't gotten to yet. It's the other boardwalk.
That's the thing. It's just not clear. Like there's a boardwalk with like a bunch of stuff on
that
it.
That whole quest you can't do until the end of the game.
You can do the first part of it. Like
yeah,
I did the first part.
You can't finish until the end of the game.
So I was Googling this and there were a lot of people, like there were threads everywhere with people being like, okay, I give up. Like how the fuck do you do this? And then they'd say, oh, it doesn't tell you very clearly. So
it's not signposted well that you have to hold it. But also it feels like it's the type of game where it's like if you play it as if with that sort of like short term like satisfaction in mind, it's not a game that's meant for completion.
I don't agree with that. I think that
everything.
Like it gives you
tasks because you can't do every quest. I think that's part of the point is that you have to like pick and choose between some of your tasks.
No,
otherwise,
but like
you just run out of time.
I agree that you can play it organically, but I don't agree that like you should not be looking at your list of tasks to do and thinking, okay, well, which one do I want to do? Because a lot of times they're just like, go do this thing.
No, you definitely should. Yeah. No, you definitely should. And it should have signposted a little better. But also, it's a mystery game, so maybe it's like it's meant to be a mystery.
Yeah, I don't mean this as like an attack or like a point of debate on this game. This is just a thing that happened. And like sometimes it doesn't word things clearly, but that's not really the thrust of where I'm going with this. I'm kind of interested in this game's worldview and the empathy. Speaking of empathy, I think this is like a really empathetic game to a really unusual degree. And okay, let me ask, I'll be vague. There's like a side quest that's sort of a side investigation that you pick up over near that building that's like northwest of the fishing village. It's like the old factory. And you find evidence of like a crime out on the dock. Do you know what I'm talking about? And Jason, I know you do, but Maddie, do you know what
I'm
talking
about? I don't
think I do. Okay, I'll just be vague then, because this is a thing you're probably about to find, and I just did this last night. So this game...
Well, had you found the quest involving it before you got there, or did you only discover it for the first time?
I only discovered it when I got there.
Interesting. Okay, I had a different experience.
And it's, you basically discover evidence of a crime, and it's like, we can take this on, or we can just like call in and give it to somebody else. I took it on.
Oh, no, wait, I do know what you're talking about. Keep going.
Oh, you do? Okay, so the guy that you find on the dock. I'll still be vague for listeners who haven't played, because it's not that important. Like, the specifics aren't that important. Have you done that whole quest, Maddie?
So, yeah, I have. And Jason, I was like you. I already knew what I was looking for before I got to the
dock. So you had, like, talked to the woman
at
the apartment?
If you talk to the woman and you go through this joke, like, set of jokes, and you take the joke too far, then it leads to a serious investigation.
Yeah,
it's
which
incredible.
Was funny because I played Day 2 twice, and the first time I played Day 2, I talked to her, and I was like, I'm not going to be an asshole to this woman. I'm just going to go. And then the second time I played Day 2, I was like, Disco Elysium is a game that rewards me for choosing weird answers, and it's constantly telling me I need to choose weird answers. I'm just gonna like tell weird jokes to this woman and then unwittingly find out a sad story about her life in so doing, and then that sets you up for this thing you find on the dock later on, which is the game. It's how the game works.
Right. And there's a view of, so I guess I'll get to where what I'm curious what you two think, but I played through that. So I had been playing this, you know, I'd come back to the game after a little while and I was like, okay, I'm just going to do this thing. I have a million things on my to-do list. I'm not totally, like, I'm a little bit scattered because it's a very busy part of the game. And I'm like, I'm just going to focus on this thing and do it. And it ends with an empathy check that I passed that then led to this, like, extremely well-written, devastating sequence of like this conversation that was just like beautiful and so human and like heartbreaking and great. And I like finished it and I was like, holy shit, I was really blown away by how good it was. And it was just this pocket of humanity in the middle of a game that so often embraces the absurd but never loses sight of that. And I think I was thinking about this because Matthew Burns, director of Eliza, friend of the show, tweeted a thing that he basically was like, I see a lot of people saying that Eliza takes no point of view or takes no stance on the issues that it raises. And I think that the people who say that haven't really thought about everything in the game, and like they haven't thought about what the game is really saying. And then some people were responding, they're like, I feel this way when I see this critique of Disco Elysium as well.
Yeah.
Because I think there is a surface level critique of this game that's like, you can do anything. You can be a fascist, you can be a communist.
You can be like all really racist. Of view, yeah. Yeah.
Right. All points of view are valid, good people on both sides, etc. Where playing the game, it's not just that the game makes fun of you for being a centrist and, like, you know, encourages you to kind of take extreme viewpoints. But this game has so much humanity, and I think you could fail that empathy check and have a very different conversation. But the fact that it was written the way that it was, and that it really carefully just let you observe this really short glimpse into a sad life of a person, and did it so, it was so much humanity. I was really impressed and was like, this is the game's point of view, is that people are human beings, and like, that's it, basically. Like, and that's actually like a really beautiful thing for a game to be about. I'm curious if either of the two of you have any thoughts.
Yeah, yeah, I have a lot of thoughts. So I, part of why I was failing that authority check was because that was during the period of time when I was trying to power level empathy because of the character Kuno, who's in the yard.
Yeah.
And the only way that you can find out what the deal is with that kid is if you pass like a legendary empathy skill check, which you can save scum, but I wasn't really save scumming. And I was like, I want to level up empathy anyway, because I was noticing by that point that you can get some really cool dialogue options the more you level up empathy, and like a few of the other ones, like figuring out if people are lying or not, I think it's called
drama is really
like some
good.
Of those ones just result in really cool dialogue choices.
That's
in my
drama
opinion.
Is hilarious when it starts encouraging when it takes you to over. Lie.
yeah, it's great. But anyway, I was trying to like power level my empathy check, and I was like, ah, fuck authority. I'm not going to worry about that right now. I don't even care about that guy, which is how I ended up having to replay all of day two. But anyway, I also had the same interaction in the game that you did, Kirk, and I don't know, I just enjoyed this game so much, and I enjoy Kuno's like horrible storyline, even though it's like the saddest shit ever. Like, it's one of those classic like video game stories where it's like, there is no right answer. And I normally hate those, but I'm also just like, it rules at the same time, because
well, there
it,
is. Well,
there kind
I won't
of
spoil
is.
Anything.
I know. I know.
Yeah,
there's
no specifics
like
on Kuno. I just want to say,
but
I haven't passed that empathy check. I'm kind of flying blind with Kuno, but he's still a fascinating character. There's so much coming out of him, even when I don't fully know how I'm proceeding with him. But at some point, I'm going to try that. But say what you're going to say, Jason.
Yeah,
I think there is a right way for Kuno, because there's, I won't spoil it, but there are things that, there's like a clear direction that he can go that makes it apparent that is the correct path.
Well, there's not like a judgment though, right? Like there isn't like a judgment of whether he's a good person or a bad person. It's not like, it's more just like, this is, there is, you're saying.
Yeah, we should
I'll put a pin on this one.
We can save some of this, I guess, for the spoiler.
And then also, I was going to say, I'm curious to hear, let's move to another game for now, because I was going to say, I'm very curious to, I want to talk about the point you just brought up about the empathy and the perspective that this game has, but I want to hear what you think of the end of the game first, because the end of the game explores a lot of those
I'm
questions.
I'm not surprised to hear that. Seems very consistent. So
let's put a pin on this one, and then maybe by the time I'm back from my leave, I'm sure you guys will both have beat it.
So we can
really dive into a spoiler cast of Disco Elysium, because I'm very excited to hear how your respective endings played out. Let's move on. I will talk about what I'm playing. I haven't had a ton of time to play video games because my wife and I have been dealing with baby stuff and just watching TV after baby goes to bed, and also NFL playoffs, which I will talk about a little bit later, because I know lots of people, including you two, have been eager for the return of NFL playoff stories.
Yeah, dying to hear it. Just dying.
But I have been playing sporadically replaying Hollow Knight on my Switch, and have made like a giant chunk of progress. I think I just got past the Crystal Mines. Decent, a few hours into the game. All games should be more like Hollow Knight. Hollow Knight is a perfect video game, and I love
it. Isn't
it
cool
so much.
Replaying it? I think I started playing it on PC for some reason. I feel like maybe I was when I was reviewing it, I was testing the PC version, but I just made a surprising amount of progress, because the second time through, you know where everything
is,
because you know the map by heart, and you're really good at it because you've beaten the Radiance or whatever. So it's like, I'm just like, okay, I don't need to get the health upgrades, whatever. And like, it's a really cool experience. You can like fly through the game.
I tried a couple of times on Iron Man mode, which is the one where I forget exactly what it's
Steel
called, but basically
Soul,
your save file. Yeah, your save file gets erased if you die. And I died on some boss and was like, at this point for me.
It's too short.
I can't do this one. Not with a child. But and then I also played this game called Lena's Inception, which is the Zelda-like game by a couple of ex-Chucklefish folks who came out and made this cool 2D game. And I really wish I loved it more. I really wish I liked it more, but something about it feels off. Like, when you make a Zelda-like action game, and I think Hollow Knight is a perfect comparison to this, you really need the mechanics, the sword swings, and the enemy attacks to just feel perfect. Like, it really has to feel just like this. It has to have this, I don't know, friction or, I don't know, tactile feel to
bounce,
it when you
bounce.
Swing
I'd say
a sword.
Hollow Knight has a bounce.
Bounce, yeah, and squishiness or lack of squishiness or like, I don't know, I always think of Zelda Link to the Past where it does have that bounce. Like you hit an enemy with your sword and you like, your character moves back a little bit, like mm-hmm. bounces back a little bit. And yeah, Hollow Knight does that same thing. I guess bounce is a very good way to put it, Kirk. And this game doesn't have that, and so it feels really weird and not satisfying to attack things, and that kind of ruins it when you're playing a Zelda game. As much as I like some of the other ideas in this game, that is kind of ruining it for me. And then returning in a Hollow Knight is like, oh, this is what a perfect mechanic feels like. This is what a perfect sword swing and perfect bounce, like jumping up and down on enemies and all the other things in that game, double jump and dashes, and everything about that game is just perfectly tuned. So yeah, it's quite an interesting contrast.
Hey Jason, you know what's cool?
Hey, what's cool?
The people who made Hollow Knight are making another whole Hollow Knight game.
Oh my god, it's mind-blowing. I hope it's like... Yeah,
man. Just taking a minute to be excited about that because that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I just hope it comes out at a time when there aren't like a bunch of other giant AAA games that I need to play for work or like want to play for work or want to play for fun, because that game is going to be a drop everything and just play this as soon as it comes out. So like, I hope it doesn't drop in the middle of like me having a review Final Fantasy VII or something like that.
Comes out the same day as the PS5.
Oh God. Oh God. Could you imagine?
That'd be such a like power move though.
Yeah, it would be.
Hopefully it's like this summer and it's like a flat summer because everyone's waiting for the fall for the big next gen launch and they're like, yep, new Hollow Knight coming out right now. And we're like, oh my God, our summers are amazing. Kirk, what are you playing?
So Disco Elysium, like I said, I started playing A Plague Tale Innocence. Is that what it's called?
Is that the rat game?
The rat game. Because I've seen a bunch of raves about this game, sort of low-key toward the end of the year. A bunch of people saying it was one of the best of the year. I started it, and it is great. It's kind of like stealth, dark.
Remind me what it is.
So it's a story of, it's like you play a young girl who, with her little brother, wind up kind of on the run. It's really dark and gritty. It's like it's in the 14th century in France.
It's an action game?
It's a stealth game. There is action to it. And I did one boss fight that was a little soulsy, but you have like a sling that can throw rocks, but it's mostly you're staying away from things. I haven't really gotten to the meat of the game because I played the first part of it. The story is good. The acting is good. It feels a little like, and I mean this in a good way, it feels kind of like an airport paperback kind of a thing. It's like historical, but I think there's like fantastical elements and it's like it's good acting and good writing and good story.
Like a Dan Brown novel of the
better. No, way better than Dan Brown. Like a good one. Okay. Like where you start and you're like, oh, I like these characters immediately. I get this. Like the little girl is like strong and interesting and she's got her little brother and they're going to get through this tough thing
it's
together.
It's only going to take you 4 hours to read it all. Yeah.
Right. And I'm going to kind of burn through it. So I started it and then I was like,
Grisham.
Okay, wait
a minute. It's like a John Grisham game.
Grisham is also a bad writer. It's like, I don't know what's better. Like maybe Stephen King.
It's like a Stephen King game.
So anyways, I started it and played the first part and was like, I'm definitely going to play this game. This seems really good, but I haven't finished Disco Elysium and I want to get back now that the holidays are over, like get back to like playing a game and finishing it. So I switched back over to Disco Elysium. So I'll talk more about that later. Like that's my initial impressions though were positive. It's pretty cool. So that's one game, Disco, which we already talked about.
I'm so proud of you, Kirk. A previous Kirk Hamilton, like a 2016 Kirk Hamilton would have been like, I'm going to play all the things at once. But now you're so focused. I'm so impressed.
He's a one-game man now.
Yeah. Doing that last year, especially in this part of the year, was just great. Like finishing Resident Evil 2, I'm kind of back in that groove. It's the best way to play because video games have endings and they're satisfying if you play all
sometimes.
The way through.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Okay, so the other game, and this is just a little related, I'll just mention it briefly, is I did start playing Monster Hunter World Iceborne, which came out on PC. And this is a similar thing where this is a forever game that is, you know, just goes on forever. You hunt these huge monsters, you grind and repeat them over and over again. You get more and more stuff. It's like an MMO, basically, especially now. It really feels like playing an MMO. It's so good. I love it. I love Monster Hunter World. I loved the game initially. I hadn't played it in a long time. They've added a ton of shit. Like, there's been a drip feed of content added to that game that I missed. And then I came in and there's like all these side quests and new monsters and like elder dragons to go hunt. And now there's a new expansion. It seems really cool. I played kind of a fair amount of it, a couple days. And it was like, you know, the feeling of, this is fun. I love this. I could play another 50 hours of this. I just, it's so cool. Like the feeling of going, you know, one-on-one with this huge ass monster and having a like, just this raucous, rowdy fight across this huge map. And they're always so exciting and hard. And you really just have to be on your game all the time. You know, it's really good. And there's a new ability that I think we talked about with someone on the show. You have now have a grappling hook that can grab onto the monster itself. They've like upgraded your grappling hook. So you're fighting and it's kind of like Attack on Titan or something. Or at least my understanding of Attack on Titan. I haven't really watched it. But like there's like a huge thing and you're like across the map and then you get close and you grab it and you fly up to its tail and you're like stabbing its tail and then it shakes you off and you like grab back onto it. So it has a more, there's like a quicker time from you being on the ground to you being up close, mixing it up, which is like really good. But I played it. I was like, okay, this is fun. I'm like basically like dressing up my character in cool outfits and trying to cool fight like monsters. I was like, okay, I could play this forever. I'm not going to. So I kind of stopped, but it's really good. And I know a lot of people like Monster Hunter. So anyways, mostly focusing on Disco now. Cool. And the only other thing I want to recommend is we finished the first season of Pandemic Legacy. Mm-hmm. The group I was playing it with, Emily and I were playing it with another couple. And holy shit, it's so good. It is crazy good. I hope the two of you are able to play it at some point. And I hope listeners get to play it at some point. This is just to sort of summarize it for people. This is a legacy game. You play 12 sessions, but up to 24 sessions because you have two tries at each month. So it's kind of like you have a game in January, game in, you know, February, game in March. You don't have to play them in those months, but like they're organized that way. And there's kind of a deck, like a legacy deck that you work through. And then for each month, there's new conditions and the story changes and the map changes and like surprising things happen. There are spoilers in this game, like big crazy stuff happens. And you have to always adapt and be like changing your strategy. And it's pushing you around and making you totally change characters and use new abilities and new inventory items. And it gets really complicated. And it's so freaking good. I like just every game came down to the final 2-3 turns. Like, no matter how different it was, like, there's so many variables at play. And it was always like, okay, we have 3 rounds left. How can we do this? Like, how can we cure the right number of diseases? How can we, like, meet our objectives? And we would figure it out. And it was like this totally cool. I can't recommend it enough. It's incredibly good. And there's a video I've started watching, a GDC talk by Rob Davio and Matt Leacock, who are the 2 designers of this game, that they gave all about like how they made it. And they say it's pretty spoiler free too, which is kind of cool. So I think it does, you know, they talk broadly about things that happen, but I'm really psyched to watch it. I've kind of started it because now I'm fascinated in the design of this game, how you even make something like this, because it's like one of the best gaming experiences I've ever had. So that's Pandemic Legacy. It's amazing. End of endorsement.
Yeah, I bought it, but I haven't found, like, I don't know. The hardest part is going to be finding people who I can commit to.
Just what,
like,
I was thinking.
Doing a monthly thing.
Like,
with
my tabletop group does not have their shit together enough for
yeah,
this.
Yeah, it's hard enough. My D&D group hasn't met in like a year because
so you
nobody
can
has
play it with just 2 people. And one of the guys in my board game night played it just with his partner, and they played the whole thing just the 2 of them. So that is
interesting.
Possible.
Okay.
It was fun with 4. Like, 4 is pretty ideal for Pandemic, but you can play with 3 or 2.
But that, yeah, if it's not as fun, and I assume you have to play with the same people every time because, like, everyone has a character.
Yeah.
And you have a character that, like, grows and gets scars and abilities, like, over the course of the game and stuff.
Yeah. I want to play with 4. I don't know.
It's so good.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be fun to play with a group. I mean, not that I'm opposed to playing games with my partner. That's always fun, but it's cool to play with more people.
It's nice. You have the appointment, and another couple would come over. We'd, like, make brunch and hang out and, like, play the game. Yeah, which was nice.
Okay, cool. So that is it for the games we're playing. Why don't we take a break and then we will talk about some news and answer some listener questions.
Hello, I'm Melissa Kirsch.
And I'm Alice Bradley.
And we're the hosts of Lifehackers podcast, The Upgrade. The Upgrade is a show about all of the ways you can improve your life.
That means how to be happier and healthier and more successful and more productive and just generally better in every way.
We talk about stuff like sex.
Very few people are like, please jackhammer me for another 45 minutes.
Psychedelics.
You don't just go on the diving board when you're 5 years old and jump in the deep end, because that would be traumatic.
And psychopaths.
Giving you exactly what you need or want without maybe you being aware that you want it.
You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, why don't we take some listener questions? Because there isn't a ton of news this week. Actually, let's talk about what did happen, but there isn't a ton to talk about. Today, this week in gaming news, a couple things happened. First of all, Sony announced that they will not be at E3 this year, therefore confirming half of one of my predictions for 2020. Now we just need one more publisher to opt out, and I will win that one. Which, by the way,
let me say for the record, I appreciate you encouraging me to change my Bloodborne prediction.
Yeah, so. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thanks.
I have seen like some people on social media and Reset Era, and even like a gaming website posting our predictions, and especially my predictions. Like, this is what insider Jason Schreier thinks
think
is
I
going
saw
to happen.
That. I think I saw that.
And like I saw people like on the Google Stadia subreddit being like, Jason Schreier thinks that Google is going to do this. And I just want to reiterate once
Didn't
again.
Didn't you specifically say on the app?
We specifically said no inside info on these predictions. Like, no. There are some things that I know are going to happen that I left out of the predictions because like that's a very specific rule, is that we just make these up for fun.
I could see it being still interesting because you do know a lot about what's happening. And so thus your predictions would be more interesting than the average Jim Oakes predictions.
But I very deliberately like make those
sure, predictions. As long as they're put in the context of, but he is saying very clearly this is not based on any inside information.
Yeah.
But it's still, I mean, people are interested in what Jason Schreier thinks is going to happen.
Sure, okay, sure. No, it's flattering. Don't get me wrong. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm whining about like, oh my God, people are paying attention.
People care what I'm
saying. What I'm saying. Oh my God.
But, no, I get what you're saying, yeah.
But it gets to a point where sometimes people will be like, oh my God, you said this was going to happen and then it didn't, and then it gets to be a pain in the ass because it's like Jason was wrong about this.
It was just a guess. Yeah.
Right. And then I saw a couple people being like, dudes, no, look at his predictions for 2019. He got zero of them right. And I'm like, see, there you go.
Now, my predictions, on the other hand, people should be posting my predictions on Twitter based
should.
On
you
my success
listening
rate.
To Maddie, although I think your predictions this year are a little more fair than your
they
predictions last year.
I was going to say, and also by that rationale, people would have been posting my predictions for last year because I won the year before.
Right.
And my predictions
and
for last year were
wrong.
Not good. Yeah.
Amazing.
Okay, so
all right.
The big news is that Sony said they're not going to be at E3. What's interesting actually is that they didn't say like, hey, first of all, they announced this through an interview with gamesindustry.biz. And second of all, they didn't say, instead of like a PlayStation blog post, which is interesting in itself, and that it follows the trend of Sony announcing things through media outlets like Wired rather than announcing things themselves, which is interesting. And then second of all, they didn't say like, oh, but we're having a PlayStation 5 meeting next month to talk about all things PS5. They just said we're going to be at other events throughout the year, which I think is bizarre. I would think that if they're going to be like, we're not going to be at E3, they would say, but here's what we're doing instead. We're having a big thing on such and such date. I think what's most likely the case is that they don't know yet. Yeah, I think that Sony's marketing, everything is still up in the air over there. I think they've had a lot of upheaval in terms of staff, especially at the higher levels in the past few months and years. So I'm sure they don't even know exactly how they're going to announce the PS5 just yet. But still, interesting stuff. I've been thinking about like, and I'm curious to hear your perspectives on this. I've been thinking about whether I even want to go to E3 this year, given that last year they leaked all our fucking personal info. And we were lucky that Kotaku wasn't on that list. But like, still, like, how can you dress them with anything?
I don't
I'm probably not going to go to E3 just because the minute I didn't have to for work, I stopped going because I don't like E3. But I think that the answer is clear. I mean, you go under a pseudonym.
Right. I will go under Max Power.
Right.
I'll be like Mark Twain.
Max Power, Kotaku.com.
I'm Drake Video Games.
Drake Video
and
Games.
And I live at the public library in Portland, Oregon.
But yeah, no, I love going to E3 every year in large part because I like just seeing the people that I never get to see who work in games and are cool and like meeting new people and stuff. But yeah, sure. I don't know. I've been giving it some
I don't like people. They all suck. Fuck them.
Yeah, no, that's I'm true. Kidding. You like staying in the
always the best part of it.
GDC is like the cool one, right?
That is. There's a lot of great people there. That's true.
Yeah, GDC is cool. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And it definitely felt last year like E3, especially on the last 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday, like it felt emptier than it had ever been. Did you notice that, Maddie? Like it felt like
it was the first time I'd ever been, but it was definitely empty as heck, and I had always seen like pictures of it, and I went in. I mean, I've been to PAX a million times, and PAX is always like just me on the verge of a panic attack due to standing in a crowd of people.
Yeah,
so I was prepared emotionally for that to be what E3 was like, and then I was sort of pleasantly surprised that I could just walk from place to place without anybody like bumping me or elbowing me. But I was also like, this seems bad. Like it's probably bad that this place has no people in it.
Yeah. No, it was wild. I think that, and they wound up putting out these stats afterwards that were like, we only had 3,000 less than the previous year. But I think that counts anyone, whether they got a day pass or a 3 day pass.
Yep.
And I think the people who got day passes probably went on Tuesday, and therefore Wednesday and Thursday were super empty. Mm-hmm. It felt really empty because Sony wasn't there. Microsoft wasn't on the show floor. They have their own thing at the Microsoft Theater, which is like a 5 minute walk from the LA Convention Center. And then just like it feels like more and more like EA hasn't been there for a few years. Activision wasn't there this year. Just like more and more, nobody wants to be there, and it just feels irrelevant for a lot of reasons. So yeah, I think this is really just the beginning of the end for E3. And I think people say that every year, but in previous years, streaming hadn't been as big a thing.
Yeah, and in previous years, they didn't dox all the journalists.
That's also true.
Yeah.
And then the other just news of the week is that Square Enix delayed their two biggest games. So Final Fantasy VII has slipped from March to April, April 10th. And then The Avengers has slipped from May to September, which is probably a very good thing given how rough The Avengers looked last year. Yeah. Right, Maddie?
Yeah, yeah. Although I still don't know if that's enough time for that game, but we'll see. Maybe I'll just try to be optimistic. Kamala's going to be in it. Kamala Khan's going to be in it. It's going to be a whole
different
game.
A lot of things can happen in a year. A game can change pretty drastically in a year, I would say. Final Fantasy VII, that's a weird one, like just a month, especially in the wake of that demo leak. Did you guys see that like the demo leaked, and like people found a bunch of plot spoilers and stuff that I've been trying to avoid reading because I don't want to know, because I mean, it's obviously most of the plot is Final Fantasy VII, but it includes changes they made, and
right,
I don't want to
like
know what
Aeris
changes they
made. Aeris isn't gonna die, for example.
Some
I'm
people
sorry,
are
spoiler,
theorizing.
Maddie, I decided not to make that joke, but I'm glad that you picked up
you
the
guys it might not be a joke. Like some people actually think
Jason,
that she's not going to die in this one.
No,
I'm telling you,
that'd be amazing.
Like,
fuck,
this is
that'd
not
be so
from
good.
Me. This
okay,
is like
here's my
theories.
Crazy theory. Those are paid Go. Actors on the part of the Final Fantasy VII marketing team trying to preserve the illusion that you can save Aeris this time. No one really thinks she's not going to die. That's
All
just
right.
paid actors.
I mean, I'm going to save this clip like in a couple of years.
Don't you think that given the age we live in, it would more be like you can download like a year after the game comes out for $5, you can download an Aeris skin for Tifa,
yes.
like in the endgame stuff.
Amazing. You can make it so that Tifa dies instead. Yeah,
oh,
sure,
God.
Why not?
yeah, there are theories involving like mystical things and like spirits and who knows, all this nonsense.
That's just marketing, dude. That's not real. That's nothing.
But yeah, what this basically means is that we'll all have to wait an extra month before we were really disappointed by how short and insubstantial this part one of this remake
Maybe
is.
Maybe it'll be great.
I still
it'll
think,
be,
by the
it'll
way...
It'll be 3 hours, but they'll be amazing. They're going to blow our minds.
Yeah.
I still... No, it felt good when I played it. Like, I played the demo at E3. It felt pretty good to play. I just think it's going to be so short and, like, thin. And I think it's... Yeah, I still think it's super misleading and fucked up that they're calling it Final Fantasy VII Remake, and, like, some people are going to go and buy this game at Target or
think
whatever,
it's all
and have
of
no
it.
Idea that they're just getting part one of this giant thing. But anyway... Yeah, so that's all the news. And then there was like a Destiny thing. Kirk, I don't know if you saw this because...
Just a little. I saw Datto tweeting about it.
Yeah, there's like a big puzzle that's like on the level of Outbreak Prime.
Yeah,
I'm going to
yeah.
dive into it more once they actually figure it out because like as of now, they haven't solved it yet. As of recording time, Wednesday afternoon, they have not solved it yet, but it seems to be this whole giant thing. And Bungie just tweeted, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So apparently it's going to take a while for people to solve it. So we'll talk more
Wasn't
about
that. Wasn't that what Bungie's first game was called, Marathon?
Yes.
Do you think that's maybe a clue?
Wow.
I'm sure someone else has already thought of that, but if I'm the first person to think of that, that would be great, because I don't even play Destiny 2 anymore.
Could it be a clue that Bungie is bringing back Marathon?
Or a new game called Sprint? Anyway.
The new sequel to Marathon
is Sprint. Actually, it's a partnership. Anyway.
I feel like Sprint would be the prequel. Maybe that's the prequel to Marathon.
That's true.
So yeah, let's take a couple of listener questions, shall we?
Let's do it.
Just a reminder, you can always send questions and whatever else to splitscreen@kotaku.com. Maddie, why don't you read us this first one?
Sure. So this is from Ankit, who writes, on the first part of the Games of 2019 podcast, Kirk said that beating Genichiro in Sekiro was one of the most difficult things he's ever done in a game. That got me curious. What would the rest of you say is the most challenging or hardest thing you've ever done in a game? Mine is beating the challenge in The Witness. It's the single feat I'm most proud of in my gaming history. I wish I was better at Soulsborne games, but I had to have Solaire help me beat Ornstein and Smog. I don't play Soulsborne games, and I
Ornstein
don't know how to pronounce those. Anyway, Jason, why don't you go first?
Let me think. So beating Bloodborne
right, why
is
don't you
pretty
not
good.
Go first?
I can go first.
I'm talking it all out loud. I'm talking it through.
Yeah.
Beating Bloodborne was up there. Especially beating Orphan of Kos, which I think I did pretty quickly, all things considered. I did it on my fourth or fifth time. But really, there are only two video games that I'm good at. One of those is Threes, and I think getting like one of the top scores in the world at Threes is definitely up there. Like a 650,000 or whatever my high score is.
Is that hard for you just on Threes? Is that actually like a challenge, or is it more that, because I feel like when you play you're like in this other sort of mental
flow
zone.
State
are you sweating mentally while you play?
Sometimes if I have a really good run and I have like a 6,000 card on the board, sometimes they'll be like, oh, gotta be careful, gotta be extra careful now, as opposed to just being in the flow state. And then the other game that I'm good at, one of the rare video games I'm good at, is StarCraft 2. And I think getting up to Diamond back in the day was pretty challenging, so I'm proud of that one. And then I guess I've done pretty well in some platformers like Jumper back in the day. But these days, I don't know, I don't know how many like gauntlets I have time for. What about you, Maddie? What's your answer?
Oh boy. So I feel like I'm going to cheat and I'm going to have multiple answers, but you did too. So
yeah,
nothing
I just
matters.
Did too.
So I was just thinking about all the different things that I find difficult in a game and how much my perception of that has changed since I played fighting games for a really long time. Like I mostly played Street Fighter like for a really long time. In the changeover from 4 to 5, that was like the few year period where I was like playing it every day. And then that like kind of reoriented my brain about how difficult other games can be, because I'm like, well, I've already fallen and gotten back up again like 1,000 times in this very reaction based game. So any other game, I'm like, how hard could this really be? I'm going to walk away from it and come back to it. So then I was just thinking about like times when I was stressed out and like had to play a game, like usually under review is when these situations have arisen in my life where I like couldn't walk away from a game and come back to it, couldn't like look up how long the fight is or like find out any information about it because I'm just like in a black box. And that's happened to me more than a few times, but one that sprang to mind was there's that boss at the end of Act 2 in Gears 5. And I was playing that game. It was during the week where video games kind of had like a miniature Me Too movement. Yeah. So that was also happening. And I remember I was like in the middle of playing Gears 5 when like Jason, you and Steven were like, we called each other and like talked about that reporting for that story. And I was like trying to beat this game at the same time, like for review. So I was like stressed out about work and like how we were going to handle those stories, but then also trying to beat this game like within a time limit. And the Act 2 boss is notoriously hard. I am not the only person who thinks that that boss
is
hard.
Yeah, that was where I stopped playing the game.
That's where you stopped playing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah.
So, like, I played that boss until 2 in the morning, at which time I beat it, because I was like, I have Saturday and Sunday to play the game, and I want to write the review Monday, or at least think about it Monday, because I think the embargo was Tuesday or something like that. I don't know. I had it all planned out. So I was like, I got to beat Act 2 tonight. And it was terrible. Like, that experience was so difficult, but I did it. And so that was really cool. But then also just a couple other shout outs. I remember hating the Guardian statue puzzle in Twilight Princess, the puzzle where, like, every time you move, another guy, I can't fully remember how it worked, but I just remember hating it, whatever that puzzle was. And I also remember the very end of Perfect Dark Zero, which is a just terrible co-op shooter that I, like, played through with a significant other at the time. I remember the end of that game being deeply irritating, where there were just a billion guys and you just had to kill like a trillion billion guys, and they just kept coming forever. And we were like, this game is dumb. Why are we doing this? So those were my other ones that I remembered.
Nice.
How about you, Kirk?
I have a bunch that are hard. Yeah, there are a variety of types of things. So Junichiro is definitely one of them. That was so hard. And, like, that was such a great fight. And that was enough for me. People have written in now, because we've talked about, Jason, you and I both didn't finish. And I got pretty far and was like, I'm not finishing Sekiro. And a bunch of people have been like, oh, finish it, it's good. And I'm like, you know, no, really, no. Like, I'm really not going to.
You're
like,
good.
I will Junichiro, say, I watched the speedrun of Games on Quick last week, and there's some stuff towards the end of the game. That dragon fight looks wild.
Divine dragon. I've seen some. I didn't get that far, but I've seen that. And then it just gets so hard, man. But Junichiro took me, I mean, like, I don't know, 6 hours. It took me so long, and that's enough. It was so hard, but that was a great fight. Like, so well made, so well designed, and finally beating him was extremely satisfying. Along those lines, also the Radiance and Hollow Knight is definitely one of the hardest things I've ever done. I'm not great at 2D platformers. That fight is so unforgiving and long, and, like, ends with this huge climax where you have to, like, climb this shit and, like, not take a single hit, and you get one more hit, and it's like, just make this last sprint, and, like, it's so stressful. And Maddie, some of what you were saying is interesting, where part of the circumstances in which you're playing the game, which you painted a big picture of, like, all these different things that were happening, and that review feeling too of, like, I gotta beat it
by a certain time.
And just anything like that that's outside and gets in your head can make things so much harder. So that's that can certainly be in there. The Valkyrie Queen in the most recent God of War is a really tough boss fight, or I had a hard time with it. It took me, like, a whole Sunday. She was really hard, and it was really rewarding to finally beat her. I wasn't, like, on a deadline or anything, but that was just tough. And then on the God of War tip, I believe this is in God of War 1, but I played both Gods of War 1 and 2. Have you guys played those games?
No.
The first ones?
The first one, yeah.
Okay, so the first game, I played them both on hard. I don't know why I was doing this. I think this was before I was a games journalist.
You like pain. We've gone over this.
It's funny because, like, I don't play those kinds of games. I'm not big into beat 'em ups. I didn't have consoles growing up. But I, like, was like, I'm going to play these on hard. And I beat I think it's the Underworld in God of War 1. Because God of War 2, you also go to the Underworld. But I believe it's in 1. There's a sequence where there's, like, fire in the room that kills you. And you have to push a statue up. Like, away from because it's fixed camera, you have to push this big statue, like, toward the fire, and it blocks the flames. But as you're pushing it, these dudes come at you from the sides, so you have to stop pushing it, and it gets pushed back every time you stop, and you have to fight the guys off and then keep pushing the statue. And, like, if you let go for too long, you die, and if the guys get you, you die. It's so hard. And there's, like, between that and then there's a platforming sections in that where you're, like, walking on these balance beams and these spinning blades will knock you off. It's so ludicrously difficult. And I remember being that and being like, that is, at the time, I was like, that is easily the hardest thing I've ever done in a video game. So that's up there. And then three things from Destiny. Jason, one that I think you're going to maybe agree with me on was getting to Mercury in Destiny 1 and Trials of Osiris.
Yeah,
that was hard. That took
us
many, many
hours. Although
it
was easier when Todd carried us. Shout out to Todd.
Our friend Todd helped us. He's very good. He didn't carry us, though. We had to carry our weight.
That's true.
We got carried later by a guy. What was his name? It was like Insane or something like that.
Yeah.
He was ludicrous. Like, that guy carried us. Like, he just would solo the other team every round because he was so good. But Todd was like, you know, he's very, very good. But we had to carry our weight. And that was such a fun challenge and so rewarding. Definitely difficult. And two other things in Destiny. One is Skolas in the Prison of Elders. Mm-hmm. This was on Voidburn. It was the week before they nerfed him. And our friends Mike and Billy and I were up until 7 in the morning doing it. It's It was so intense, like psychologically, like by the, we literally did it for like 8 hours, and it was the three of us, and we're like, we can't quit. We can't quit. We have to do this. But like, it is 6 a.m. and I am like wrecked, and I don't know how. And then we finally did it, and it was extremely, I think I still have a GIF somewhere of like, I like me like shooting it with a sniper rifle and then him dying. And like the feeling of relief, it was just like, it's over. I can go to sleep and have my life back. It wasn't even like we beat him. I didn't even think we got anything good out of it, but it was so hard. It was ludicrously hard. And then they nerfed him the next week because he was too hard. Mm. And the only other thing from Destiny is I did the Fogoth Nightfall solo in Destiny 1, which is crazy because in Destiny 1, if you die, you like get sent back to orbit during the Nightfall. I think it's that way again. But like this was like so uncompromising. You couldn't mess up at all. I did the whole thing solo. I used whatchamacallit, the icebreaker, the sniper rifle that regenerated bullets, and just hid in the safe room and like just kind of cheesed the boss. And it took me like 3 hours, but it did it. Did it by myself. And it was very difficult. And that's a lot of things, but those all came to mind. And I think this is a really fun topic. So I want to say we're going to move on to the next letter. But listeners, we want to hear from you. So write us, write into splitscreen@kotaku.com. Tell us the hardest thing you've ever done in a video game. I know we all broke the rules, but try to keep it to one thing if you can. Because we, because Maddie and I are going to be maybe reading them next week on the show. We'll like read through the best ones or the, you know, the most funny ones. So send us funny stories, whatever exciting tales of victory. The hardest thing you've ever accomplished in a video game. splitscreen@kotaku.com. We can't wait to hear from you.
Cool. Let's get through a couple more questions because there's some interesting ones here. First, let me read this one. This is from We Go Giant, he goes by, or she goes by, they go by. Hi, everyone. I just returned home from Awesome Games Done Quick 2020, which is a lot of fun. For those of you who don't know about it, GDQ is a twice annual video game speed running charity marathon. We raised over $3 million for the Prevent Cancer Foundation. My question for the host of Split Screen is this. Have you ever learned to speed run a game before? If not, which game would you choose? So speed learning how to speedrun a game essentially means playing it over and 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 over again. I don't think any of us have the time or bandwidth or energy or interest in doing something like that. But that said, I think if I were to speedrun a game, I think I could be pretty decent at speedrunning Super Mario World, which I remember is something I tried to do one time when I was at Kirk's house and we were streaming. We were doing like one of our Twitch streams.
I will give you credit for how impressive it was.
Yeah, I think I could beat that game in, I think I beat that game in something like 20 minutes or half an hour. I think I could get that time down. So if I were to speedrun a game, I think that would be the one that I would go with because it would have to be something super low impact. Like I could never speedrun like an RPG, which some people do, which are like like hours and hours of just like sitting there, not even taking a pee break because you're playing an 8 hour speed run. Like that just seems absurd to me. What about you guys, Maddie? What about you? Do you think you could ever speed run a game?
I wouldn't because I don't have the stamina and I would get tired of the game. So I much respect to the people who can do that. But I was trying to think of a game I wouldn't get tired of, and Super Metroid is an obvious answer in my case. I think I could probably play that game a billion times and learn its ins and outs. Also, like, I know where everything is, so that part would be easy at least. But I also watched the Untitled Goose Game speedrun, and that was really, really fun to watch. And it made me like kind of want to learn some of the tricks in it. And then I was like, is this doing something to my brain where like I'm enjoying a speedrun too much and now I want to try a thing? But I'm sure it's not actually, it's like probably almost completely impossible. But there were just a couple moments when they would like take a shortcut that I was like, I could have done that. I bet I could do that one just to speed up that one part that's kind of tricky. It was fun to watch that. How about you, Kirk?
I guess I draw a distinction between figuring out how to speed run it and just like watching a speed run and doing what they're doing. I could try the latter. That might be fun. But the former seems crazy because the time commitment, like they both said, is too much. I think, so I'm not totally sure what I would do, though I was thinking about this and I liked when Heather Alexandra wrote about trying to speedrun Breath of the Wild because she was covering the speedrunning beat on that game, which is like so good for speedrunning because it's so open-ended. She had been covering it and then wrote this cool article. The headline is, we can link it in the show notes, The Hardest Things About Trying to Speedrun Breath of the Wild. And it was a really fun article and it made me think that would be fun to at least try some of those tricks, you know, putting yourself on the boulder and launching yourself off at the beginning so you can get going, trying to get to that boss fight and trying it with, you know, no weapons, but like looking at how people do it. I don't think I'm good enough to do it or anywhere close to good enough to, especially to beat, you know, Calamity Ganon. Just that was hard enough for me with like all my gear.
Yeah, with all the
but I think that would be a fun one to try. So I think I'd think about that.
And with his health knocked down because you beat the Guardians.
Right.
Like, imagine trying to beat him without all the Guardians.
You need to be so good. I just don't think the combat in that game is good enough to get that good at it, honestly.
But yeah, GDQ last week was a lot of fun. There are some runs. Man, there was this run of Final Fantasy VI that they were doing things I've never seen before to break that game, and it was incredible. It was so much fun to watch. I'll probably write it up on Kotaku as soon as they put up the YouTube video. Kirk, why don't you read this next question?
Okay, this comes from Joe. Joe writes, so for a while, my bold prediction for the future of Xbox was that the next Xbox would just be a gaming PC. Could we still be in a world where that still happens? What if the Xbox Series X, S, Z, Triple X, whatever, ran a Windows OS under the hood?
Man, I really, really wish Microsoft would do this because I think that would be so killer and just like destroy. Like, that would, a future of consoles that looked like that would make me so happy. Just like open-ended platforms that let you just like do whatever you wanted would be so damn cool. I think it's possible that that these next-gen consoles are more modular than previous consoles, not in the sense that I think you'll be able to like take out the RAM and start improving your graphics card or whatever, but like maybe you'll be able to get a new solid-state drive, and instead of having to plug it in on the outside, maybe there'll be like a space on the outside where you can take out the old one and or like if it's a small like M2 card, take out that one and put in a new one or something like that.
Like maybe the memory cards that you could plug into an N64.
So yeah, exactly. So maybe it'll be like easy mode modular, but like if it ran Windows and like let you use Steam or whatever, I think that would be so killer and like so much better than trying to do this whole Xbox thing, especially because Microsoft isn't even trying to do exclusives anymore. They just reiterated that they're not doing Xbox Series X exclusives, at least for the first couple of years, which is something, I mean, I've been saying for years now that Microsoft's strategy is going to be the phone thing where like their games are forwards and backwards compatible and then eventually like they go obsolete, but like they aren't looking at exclusives as the future anymore, and they're putting all their games on PC anyway, which I think Sony will do also, hint hint, but I do think that Microsoft's approach is not quite as effective as Sony's is when it comes to a living room console, and I think making their console a PC would just like be killer and like win them the generation in all sorts of ways. What do you guys think?
Yeah,
I agree with you. I feel like we're already like almost there because I can play so all my Xbox games on my PC, and like we already live in that awesome version of the world. Why wouldn't
why not
the other
vice versa?
Way?
Yeah, right. Why not vice versa? Like, man, imagine if you could get all your Steam games on like an Xbox that you buy for $500, and it's basically like a mid-range PC in your living room that is customized. Maybe even if it isn't modular, it's just like, so because it's a console and it's just like a designed as a singular machine, and maybe they even sell it as a loss still. It's more powerful than you can get for a PC at the same price, and it still does what your PC does. Man, I'd be so stoked about that. I wish that was what Microsoft did.
Yeah, even if they just let you stream from Steam to a console, that would be really cool. Because I say that because that's how I've been playing so much Disco Elysium, is on my laptop. So right. Like,
nice.
It'd be really cool if you could just do that with a console. But
yeah.
So many of the pieces are in place for that to work.
I know.
It seems like, why not make it official, guys? Take the final step.
Yeah, and it's crazy that like Valve couldn't make it work. It's almost like, yeah.
I mean, I have that thing, the Steam box. It's great.
Yeah.
The Steam machines. Remember they were doing machines, and then they were like, actually we're gonna let all these other companies
exactly.
do it, and
that was the whole thing is like Valve thing. Doesn't have a like hardware division that was doing that where Microsoft does, so like Microsoft would be a way better company to do the same kind of idea. Man, Steam machines was so weird. What the fuck was that even?
Yeah, man, my conspiracy theory or like speculative theory was always Microsoft should buy Valve and then put Steam on these like make an Xbox that's essentially the Steam machine with Steam on it, and you can play all your Steam games and you can get anything on
Steam. I would prefer, especially given how many games I'm playing that aren't on Steam. Can I tell you guys, I just started using desktop shortcuts to play all my PC games. Am I the only person who wasn't doing
that?
What
do you mean?
Do you two do that? Like, my games are now organized, like the whatever eight or so games that I regularly play.
Did you not do that before?
No, I would go into the, I would launch them via Steam. I did it way back when I was initially playing, but I would like go into Steam and like just press play. I would like browse my Steam library, or I'd go over to the Epic Store to like play Outer Worlds or whatever. But now I just like put them all on my desktop, and now it's like, it doesn't matter what the store I bought them from is. They're all just, all the whatever games I'm playing are just right there. So much better. And and that, I do think like removing, it removes the idea of these stores because the games are just right there. And it'd be cool if, I mean, if it was only Steam, that's fine, but it'd be nice if they're going to make it a PC, like if Xbox can play PC games, that it can play anything. One of the things I like about the Steam streaming box I have is you can play anything on that. Like you can play games from the Epic Store via that thing. It just streams whatever is on your PC. You could like watch a movie on your PC and like stream it to your TV. So that, I think it'd be nice if it was just completely open-ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if they don't do the streaming thing and they just make it so you can actually just download Steam games and play it on your Xbox, I think that Xbox's hardware strategy, like the whole, like, okay, Xbox Series X is going to come out, and then maybe in 2 years, Xbox Series X2 or Xbox Series Y or whatever the next one is, and that's more powerful and it'll also play the previous gen's games, but maybe we'll stop supporting Xbox One original games and so on and so on. That would make so much more sense if it was like PC games. And
Completely
and now
agreed.
You can play this as different at different resolutions based on which model you have, and it would just be a perfect system with Steam. So, man, that's my dream.
That's
why
it'll never happen, because it would be
it's
too
just
easy.
Too good to be
and
true.
Companies don't work together that
much
way.
More sense.
Microsoft's been making good decisions. We'll
yeah,
see. It
yeah,
could happen.
And like
it's
combine
out
that,
of the realm of possibility.
Has Valve been though?
Right, that's the thing. But you combine that with Xbox Game Pass, and you just have this killer thing. But I don't know. Maybe they can work some arrangement around like the Windows Store or whatever, who knows? But like, man, Microsoft, if you're listening, this would just be so cool,
man. And then you could like plug an Oculus Quest into that thing,
yeah,
you could, like and then you could play the Half-Life game or whatever, and like also have like, that, man, that would be really great. That would be very very friendly to people.
And then you no longer have to think about like whether a game, oh, is this game coming to my Xbox? No, it's just on PC. Oh no, I have to worry. Like, imagine
just
if there was just no distinction. Yeah.
It would just
be
PS4 and Switch would
still.
That'd
be so cool. Yeah, but like, even I would love a future. I mean, my ideal future is like no console distinctions and everything is just like that would make everyone's lives easier. But since that's not going to happen,
you want an ultimate monopoly where there's only one console? Then it would suck ass.
No. Like five, I want an open platform where everyone is like on a PC architecture, and like any console can play anything. So like you want a Switch, you can play low end games on the go, or like
or
you
can play like XCloud or stream Stadia or whatever.
I want
to a Switch.
More open gardens is what I would love to see. Just like everything being totally open. Anyway,
all right.
Let's do this one last question. Matt, do you want to read this one?
Sure. So this is from Injong, who says, longtime listener and big fan here. I had a question for the three of you regarding crunch in the games industry. How do you think working remotely could affect crunch, if at all? I feel like more and more people are telecommuting these days, and it seems like that might only become more common in the future. Having said that, I have no idea what percentage of game developers work from home or how common it is in the industry to do that currently. Would love to hear your thoughts. Love the show and keep on podding.
I think this is an interesting question because, just personally speaking, when I work remote, and I'm curious to hear your guys' perspective, but I'm the only one who works in the office and works remotely. When I work in the office, I have very strict like start and end times. I come in at 9, I leave hopefully 5:30, usually closer to 6, but like it's very clear when my workday ends. When I work from home, I find myself just like doing the same thing and like staying in Slack and continuously doing what I've been doing or working or doing whatever. And there's no, like, it all blends together, the home time and the work time. It all, there's just no clear distinctions. So I think that, like, it's possible that it might lead to more crunch. It's also possible that it's, like, a different kind of crunch because working on something feels very different. Like, it feels a lot more relaxed. It feels a lot less stressful when you're at home and you can make your own meals and don't have to worry about, like, ordering in or going out and buying lunch or whatever. And you can kind of take a break and go do something with your family or even watch a TV show in the middle of the day, whatever you want to do, you have a lot more flexibility. So you guys both work remote. What do you think of this? Do you think that like it could mitigate crunch or make it worse or both or neither?
I mean, it depends what kind of manager you have, right? I mean, even if you're working remotely, you still might not necessarily have any flexibility to take a break in the middle of the day and watch a TV show or see your family. You might not. You might have specific quotas that you're having to hit. And I feel like the danger that I see, and I've certainly experienced it in my own life because I've worked from home as like a freelancer and just in general for many, many years now. It's just, it's very common in our industry for people to do that. So I have experienced people saying, well, since you don't have a commute, why don't you just go ahead and do this extra thing? Like that's just across the board something that happens to me. And I totally get it. And it's completely true. And also I am the person who will be like, that makes sense. And then I end up never not working. And I just have to draw my own boundaries in my own life. We're like, well, I'm going to stop looking at Slack or stop looking at my work email or whatever. And I'm terrible at doing that. Jason knows. I basically am never capable of separating myself and doing
that. You both are terrible at doing that.
I know, we're awful at it. Don't be like us. It's terrible. But I think that part of the reason why I'm so bad at it is because I work from home. And I remember like when I had to go to the Phoenix offices, like my Phoenix computer had all my shit on there and I couldn't do anything at home. So like that there was like this very specific division. And when I worked at MIT, it was the same way. For MIT Press, we had like a VPN and all that stuff. So like I had to go to the offices at MIT to write articles for them and then go home. So like there's upsides and downsides. Anyway, Kirk, what do you think? You've worked from home a lot.
Yeah, almost exclusively. I mean, I, you know, would go teach at the school I taught at. And then I had like a desk job for a year and did that. But those are the only offices I work in. Also, I am garbage at working in the Kotaku office. Like when I was still at Kotaku.
It's so hard. So I'm too used to working from home now.
Oh, yeah. Like I've gotten good at working from home, but I go to the office and I'm like so distracted. Like, let's just talk about movies.
Uh-huh. I will say a large chunk of my day is often occupied by Steven telling me what he did in the Division 2 the previous day.
Hey, I mean, like that's nice. A part of my day is occupied by that too.
Uh-huh. It's always nice. Part of all of our days is just hearing what Steven's been doing in the Division 2.
In his latest game. So I guess a couple of thoughts are, one, I know that in like tech and in sort of the like high paid tech sector, which video games count as part of, there's definitely like a move toward working remotely. I've seen articles about it in like trend pieces, and I'm pretty sure that that is happening. I am curious about this, whether, because I don't know. So if I'd be curious to hear from anybody who, if you like work at a big studio and you've been there for a while, like if you've actually seen a trend moving in this way, because I know that a lot of game development is done in person. Like there's definitely that is valued in the industry. And I don't know whether it's more or less than, you know, some other software development job. But so I'm curious whether that is more of a thing. And then, yeah, it's kind of like my thoughts are really just along the lines of what you were kind of saying, Jason, is that crunch culture is its own thing, and like video game crunch is such a kind of constrained thing. Like I know that crunch can look like a lot of different things, and it's mostly just overwork, but so much of it seems to be the stories that I hear are so about the physical space and the people sleeping under their desks and being stuck in this office and the feeling of...
And having the catered lunches that they don't
the
want.
The catered lunches and the beer.
The fluorescent
and like the
lights.
Right, and everyone's exhausted, but you're kind of obligated to stay there and you can't leave because you want to go home. And also such a big part of the cost of crunch, in addition to the psychological cost, well, it's part of the psychological cost, is not seeing your family and your loved ones and like having a social life. And like you said, Jason, and when you're at home, it's such a different feeling. Like you're with your, you know, if you have kids, you're like, your kids could be there. Like they go home from school, you're there, you're working, but like they're there and you can kind of take a break and go see them. And
it's definitely different. Yeah.
Such a huge difference that it's almost like you're talking about a really significantly different kind of thing. And it could still be bad. It could still be like problematic, overwork, et cetera. But that is a very different proposition. So I would think that's one of the biggest differences if more and more people are working remotely. But those are just some kind of broad thoughts.
Yeah. But then the risk is that your boundaries get crossed.
And
you're like, oh, you know what?
Like you were saying, yes, like Maddie was saying, that is absolutely a thing that happens when you're working from home. Yes.
Yeah. Well, for us, it's media jobs are a little bit different because you're more expected to be available all the time because news can happen.
News
at
keeps
any time,
happening. It's
or
crazy.
A story
really
can
being
break
a critic, the way that you're like always playing games and
watching
shit.
Or you
and
come up with an idea
in
the middle of the night and you're
but
like, I gotta write this.
In games development, I think because it's such a creative field, it can be almost like dangerous to be like, oh, you know what? Well, I'm not going to, I have this idea on a Saturday, but I can't do anything with it right now because I'll wait till Monday when I can get to my desk and all my tools are at the office. So I'll just wait, as opposed to, oh, I work from home. My tools are over here. I have this great idea. Why don't I just plug in a few hours and like suddenly you're working all weekend on this thing for that isn't like for yourself. It's for some AAA like Bobby right. Kotick who's making millions of dollars. And yeah, there's a lot of factors of all this and to all this. And yeah, it's an interesting topic, but we should probably keep moving. So why don't we take another break and then we will get into a few off-topic things and then say goodbye. Okay, Kirk, Maddie, let's talk about some things that we are doing that have nothing to do with video games. Kirk, hit us up first.
Sure. So I've just been watching lots of movies and TV shows and stuff, but one podcast that I've been listening to, I have been listening to only this podcast for the last couple of weeks since I discovered it, which has been very nice for just because I haven't been listening to any political podcasts, and that's been... It's been
keep
good.
That
it's,
up, I
yeah,
would
say. Yeah, I think I'm gonna. I think that this
based
wasn't
on nothing.
Just, this wasn't a 2020 resolution, but it's made me realize that I am very informed. I am fine. I know what's happening. I read the news every day. Listening to people talk about politics. Yeah. So, anyways, that's been a good. It's been a good shift. I might stick with it. But the main reason I have been listening to other podcasts is because I've been listening to a movie podcast. It's called Blank Check with Griffin and David. I'm sure some of our listeners know it. They're a pretty big podcast. The two hosts, Griffin Newman, who is an actor, who I found out after I'd been listening for a while, he played Arthur on The Tick on Amazon Prime. He's like in a bunch of stuff. He's like a working actor, and he knows he's a legit actor. And it was funny to have been listening to the show and then been like, oh, it's that guy. Like, holy shit, I watched that show. He was good in it. So it's him and then David Sims, who is a movie critic at The Atlantic. He's a really good critic. They're the two main hosts. They have a rotating series of guests. They're in New York. It's like a bunch of New York film people. Richard Lawson, former Gawker guy. Joe Reed, a really cool former television. It's like all these people that I kind of know from the internet are on this show, but I'd never listened to it. It's a great show. It's so fun. It's like really movie nerdy. Griffin in particular is this like knows an insane amount of trivia because he like, I think his family is kind of in the industry. So he grew up like knowing everything about box office and stuff. It actually makes me think it would be so nice if we had a box office style thing for video games, only because it's a fascinating thing to listen to them talk about a movie from like 1994 and like what dominated the box office that week. And they just have the numbers at their disposal and they go through it. And it's like, it's really cool. It's an interesting, like,
it is unfortunate that like video game sales are so opaque.
And even though like sales, nobody. And it's not like the most interesting measure of the success or failure of a thing. It's nice that there's just this number that you can just look at and it starts the conversation. And they do that a lot. Yeah. They talk about box office a lot. But anyways, it's a really cool podcast. And the theme is that they do like filmographies. So they'll do like a director, and Blank Check means like a director. Like the one I've been watching is James Cameron. So that's a good example. He made like a Piranha movie that was like one of those Piranha, like it was before he was anybody. And then when he made Aliens, it was this huge hit. So he gets a Blank Check. And then the idea is like, what are the movies he makes now that he can make whatever he wants? So they've done they did one on Brad Bird. That's really cool. It's like all of his animated movies. They've done, I don't know, a bunch of different directors. I'm kind of catching up on their backlog. So that's just a podcast recommendation. Because of that, I've been watching some James Cameron stuff because they've been going through James Cameron, which is a really fun series of conversations. I like James Cameron movies. And man, one thing I didn't know about James Cameron that I learned from this show is that every movie James Cameron has made since Aliens has been the most, since Aliens has been the most expensive movie ever made. Did you know that?
So, like in succeeding increase of expense?
He made Terminator 2, most expensive movie ever made. True Lies, at the time, most expensive movie ever made. It cost like $115 million. And then Titanic, most expensive movie ever made. And then Avatar, most expensive movie ever made. And probably
Avatar
2.
Somebody stop that guy. Also. Somebody tell that guy about like Excel budgeting. Mm-hmm. Like
oh, and The Abyss. I think The Abyss was also the most expensive movie ever made. I might be wrong about that one. So it's like every movie, he's like, well, it's going to be the most expensive. Because True Lies is such a weird one because that movie like doesn't need to be the most expensive movie ever made. It's kind of... It could have cost like half as much as it. They didn't need to actually blow up a bridge or whatever the way they did at the end of that movie. So anyway, it's been cool going through his movies and like appreciating him. I watched Aliens, which when was the last time the two of you saw Aliens?
Probably a few years ago. Alien and Aliens are some of those movies that I just rewatch every few years.
Kind of the same.
As a Metroid fan, I can't not.
What about you, Jason?
I think I've only seen the first one.
Oh, man.
Fine.
So
first one's great.
First one is great. And so
they're
very different
right. also. They're,
oh,
because
yes.
they have different directors, different sensibilities, yeah. etc.
So, So Alien is, I promise not to talk forever, though I kind of want to. Alien is great. I rewatched Alien. I had seen it, I think, but not really when I was reviewing Alien Isolation. It wound up being like a crucial thing to have for context for that game, which is this like amazing mm-hmm. re-encapsulation of that movie. The first Alien is amazing, amazing movie. That's Ridley Scott. Like,
it's one of the
sci-fi
greats.
Classic. Definitely one of the greats. Aliens, at the time I was like, oh, yeah, Alien is better than Aliens because Aliens is like more of an action movie. I rewatched it and it's not really, I mean, it's kind of an action movie, but it isn't really. It's so good. Like Aliens is such a cool movie, especially the director's cut, the like longer version, because they cut mm-hmm. out a bunch of stuff because it was kind of before he was like able to be like, no, you're not cutting anything out. My movie is going to be 2.5 hours long. So really cool movie, less of an action movie than I thought. Great designs, like really cool shit in it. Really good. I haven't rewatched True Lies, but oh wait, one more thing about Aliens. This is another thing I learned from that show. Sorry. Apparently, I think this is true. I'm purely going off this podcast. I hope they're not lying. When James Cameron pitched the studio executives on Aliens, he went up to a whiteboard and he wrote the word alien, and then he put an S on the end, and then he turned the S into a dollar sign. That was how he pitched that movie. So that's a great story. Anyway, that's a good podcast. I'm just stealing all their best stuff. I just listened to their episode on True Lies, which I loved that movie when it came out in 1994. Loved it. Haven't watched it in a while. Now, like when listening to people talk through the plot of that movie, it's like a movie that's really entertaining and has some really fun sequences, but is super fucked up in a lot of different ways. It's like both, like, it's super sexist, it's super racist, like it has this whole sequence. Do you both remember this movie?
I have never seen it. No.
Oh, wow.
Should I watch it?
I mean, maybe not. Like, it really, like, it just doesn't strike the right balance. That, you know, the story is like, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a spy, but he's pretending to be a normal guy, and his wife mm-hmm. is like bored and she's maybe having an affair, and then he like basically redirects all of the resources of the like Omega Sector super spy agency that he works for in order to like block her having an affair with this guy. And then there's this scene where he like interrogates her. She's like behind the one-way mirror and they're using the scary voice to try to find out if she like had sex with the guy ever. And it's like a real, it's, there's a lot of stuff in it that is like this.
So it's like the ultimate power fantasy, basically.
Yeah. And it's real. And it doesn't do the thing where like, he's kind of a parody of himself, but it doesn't do the thing where it's like, he is eventually it flips around on him and he realizes he's been horrible. Like there's just the sense that the movie is like, no, he was basically right. Like boys will be boys. And he kind of did this thing and now they love each other. I mean, they come to an understanding. Jamie Lee Curtis is like super good in it and it has good stuff. Anyways, that was interesting to be like, True Lies, what a weird fucking movie that was. And mm-hmm. while I loved it at age 14, I was like not aware that like all of this shit that was like really messed up about it was messed up. And so that was also an interesting thing to think about. And anyway, this is a great podcast. Makes me revisit cool movies. I want to rewatch Avatar. It's making me like feel better about liking Avatar.
You should rewatch it.
I'm psyched for Avatar 2, man. I'm going to go see that shit in IMAX 3.
Wow, you are the only one.
Are you psyched for the Avatar video game?
Oh, the Ubisoft one, right?
Yeah, it's made by Massive, the Division people.
I never played it. I remember thinking it was interesting.
No, it's not. Well, you never played it because it's not. It hasn't been shown.
It never came out.
What?
Apparently.
No, the Avatar video game. Oh, not the one you're talking about. There was an Avatar video game when Avatar.
Oh, maybe
the
like
movie
a movie license.
Ubisoft
game.
Released
yeah, this
one.
Is going to be. Oh, no, this is different. This is like a brand new one.
No, I don't know about that. I was interested in the fact that there was like kind of a real video game based on Avatar where you played as like, I think you switched between playing as a Navi and a Space Marine. I never played it. I think it was like not that great, but it was better than you maybe would have thought and seemed kind of interesting. Anyway, I've gone on long enough.
All right, let's move along. Maddie, what about you?
Sure. I watched Parasite last week. I thought it was great. Kirk,
so
have you seen it yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Loved
great.
It.
So
such
without
a good movie.
Spoiling it, I guess I'll just say, and I'm sure you guys share in this, it is hard to recommend or describe this movie because it's called Parasite, so people think it's gonna be a horror movie, a la Alien.
That's
so you
exactly
have to be like,
what I thought.
No, it's not a supernatural movie, it's not a science fiction movie, doesn't have an actual literal parasite in it, more of a metaphor, really. Also, people keep saying to you, it's better if you go in knowing nothing about it. Mm-hmm. But if you're like a baby and you're afraid of movies, which is what I usually am, you hate it when people say that because you're like, just fucking tell me if this movie's going to freak me out or not. So I don't know. And also, like, I know a lot of people who think this movie was scary. I did not find it scary at all, no. Except insofar as extreme wealth disparity is very, very scary.
It's more tense than scary.
It's tense. It's high pressure. But it's also really funny. I have a very mm-hmm. dark oh, yeah. sense of humor. And this movie is very dark and very funny and extremely sad, good. But it's like funny sad. And I don't know. I think maybe it's a horror movie if you're a really rich person. I will say that. I think that's maybe true. So anyway, those are my thoughts on Parasite. I definitely recommend it.
Or if you're not a rich, but really it's a horror movie for everybody. Like not.
Well,
like,
it's different. I would say it's like a different type of horror if you relate more to the poor family and you're like rooting for them, mm-hmm. as opposed to if you relate to the rich family and you're like, oh no, I feel bad for what's happening to them. Like I think you would have a very different experience of the film depending mm-hmm. on which family you related to. I thought the poor family, I was rooting for them. That is mm-hmm. what I will say.
I was at first, though there did come a point where I was like a little less rooting for them.
Yeah.
I want to say, Maddie, this is actually recommending to listeners something you recommended to me related to Bong Joon-ho, the director, which is the yes. Rhino Stew video that I'm sure everyone saw because it has 7 million plays on YouTube, but I'd never seen
it. My good friend Luke Palmer mm-hmm. made this video. I have to disclose this. Right. He made a video.
A fantastic video.
An incredible YouTube video that already has done very well, and I'll happily recommend it again, about how Snowpiercer bears striking similarity to the plot of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
And it's like a sequel. It's so
convincing, this video.
It feels
like it's a sequel
video.
To Willy Wonka, and it's great. And Luke makes really funny YouTube videos. People should check out his stuff.
I went in. So this is Snowpiercer, also directed by Bong Joon-ho. Different movie, but really good. I went into this video thinking, oh, this is just going to be fun or whatever. And by halfway through, I was like fully had my tinfoil hat on and was like, this is legitimately, this is supported by the movie. Like this, I was so into it. It's so good. There's all these YouTube videos in the recommended feed, like next to the video, that are like more connections, like follow up, like it spawned an entire subgenre of like theory video. It's so great. We'll link it in the show notes. People should totally watch it.
Yes.
Yeah, Jason, Parasite is awesome. I hope it wins the Oscar.
Me
because
too.
It totally deserves to be Best Picture based on the ones I've seen.
Cast
so
deserved to be nominated. That was a frustrating snub that none of them got nominated.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some of that is them is like America bias. Like
being in Korean.
Yeah. Okay, so I saw Jojo Rabbit, which is really fun, and starts off feeling really uncomfortable until you start to get what it's going for. Mm-hmm. Have either of you guys seen it?
No. I haven't yet. I want to.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you know the premise, right? The premise is that it's about this little boy who's a hardcore, dedicated Nazi, and he's obsessed with Adolf Hitler mm-hmm. to the point where Adolf Hitler is his imaginary friend
right?
And so you watch the first few minutes, and it's like, oh my God, what is this movie? Because it's like him having a grand old time as a Nazi, and like going to this Nazi youth gang, and they all have such a good time. And then it starts to reveal itself, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I had some issues with it, but overall, just liked it.
I noticed that Scarlett Johansson was nominated for supporting actress for that movie mm-hmm. and also for actress for Marriage Story. And I'm trying to remember the last time someone pulled that, like got nominated for both actors.
I'm sure Meryl Streep has done it.
Yeah,
maybe. She would be the one, wouldn't she? That's pretty impressive, though. Good for Scarlett.
Yeah, I don't know, but I don't know if she was Oscar worthy in this movie. She was very good,
she got nominated.
But I don't know about Oscar worthy. But yeah, it's a fun movie. I recommend it. And now it is time for the thing you've all been waiting for, the NFL playoff update. I haven't really done one of these in a long time, but I have a good story to tell you guys about the NFL playoffs.
Okay.
So. As you both know, for many, many years now, since the dawn of Tom Brady, the New England Patriots have been kind of the dominant force in the NFL. They've been the evil empire. They cheat, they dominate, they win every single year. Everyone gets sick of them being in the playoffs, being in the Super Bowl.
Is Jason personally trolling my mother, a loyal listener and loyal Patriots fan. Shout out, Mom. Continue, Jason.
Shout out to Maddie's mom. So the Patriots, for the past 10 years, I believe, at least the past, basically the past 10 years, they have made it to at least the second round of the playoffs. Usually they get a bye, which means they don't even have to play the first week of the playoffs. There are 4 weeks of the NFL playoffs, four rounds basically, and usually they can skip right ahead to the second one. This year, the Patriots entered week one of the wild card weekend as the number three seed because they had been knocked off the previous week by the Dolphins, which were a terrible football team that somehow beat them at the last minute of this exciting football game in which the Patriots probably should have won. But anyway, so the Patriots come in and they're playing the Tennessee Titans in Foxborough Stadium in New England, and the Patriots are favored by five and a half points. They're expected to win. They usually win games in Foxborough. The Patriots usually win games, period. Most people expect them to make the Super Bowl every year because they basically do. Last year, as you guys remember, they won the friggin' Super Bowl. Year before, made the Super Bowl. Year before that, won the friggin' Super Bowl. They just fucking win the Super Bowl.
Could the story be going?
So the Titans come in, and the Tennessee Titans are led by two key characters. One of those characters is named Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry is a truck in human form. He is a running back, 6'4", like 200-something pounds, just steamrolls people. And he turned out to be the best running back in the NFL this year. Mm. He came out to play. He like ran for 200 yards nearly, a bunch of touchdowns. He was incredible in this game. The other character of our story is a little bit more interesting. He's this guy named Ryan Tannehill, who for his career, the past like 5 years, has just been a totally average quarterback. Like nobody thought anything about him. Somehow, he took this Titans team and led them to victory over the New England Patriots, and the New England Patriots were sent home. Well, everybody thought, okay, Patriots weren't actually that good this year. The Titans, they might be hot right now. They're like on this great winning streak. They have Derrick Henry, who's just incredible at rushing the football. But you know what? They're just going to lose next week. Cut to this past weekend. The Titans head to Baltimore to face the Baltimore Ravens. Now, the Baltimore Ravens this year were the best team in the NFL, period. Straight up. They went 14-2. They had Lamar Jackson, who I'm sure you guys have heard of by now because he is the consensus MVP, one of the best players in the league. Just a super exciting quarterback who like runs around just like as good as any running back, except he's also a quarterback and can throw the ball, and he's just impossible to stop. The Tennessee Titans come in, and the Ravens are favored to beat them by 10 friggin' points. 10 points. Earlier in the day, the 49ers had played the Vikings, and the 49ers were favorites, and the Vikings, everyone thought, oh, these guys are spunky. They won the previous week, and in an upset over the Saints, maybe they could come in and beat them, and the 49ers just smashed them. So it's like, okay, you know what? Back to week two of the NFL playoffs, things are like proceeding as expected.
No more upsets.
Tennessee, no more upsets possible this weekend. Tennessee Titans come in to Baltimore. Suddenly, they're up 7-0. Suddenly, they're up 14-0. Suddenly, they're up 21-6. Lamar Jackson like can't throw a friggin' pass to save his life. He's like playing the shittiest that we've ever seen him. The Ravens cannot accomplish anything. They can't stop Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry runs for another 200 yards inexplicably. Like, it makes no sense what he is doing on the football team. The way this guy runs, because sometimes, like, a little bit of football geekery for a second here, so you'll have to spare me.
A little bit of football geekery.
I haven't been able to do this in a long time, so you have to spare me.
And you can't do it for four more weeks, so we gotta let him go. A little bit of actual granular football talk.
Okay. So oftentimes a running team, a team that likes to run the football as opposed to pass it, will come up with all these like schemes and confusing line formations and blocking formations to like confuse the opponents. And a lot of times that can be really effective because the defenders think that the running back is going to go like to the left and he actually goes to the right, or they think he's going to go inside and he goes outside, et cetera, et cetera. Oftentimes that's like a big part of football strategy, is like to deceive your opponent.
The flying V. This is the Mighty Ducks. I know it's not football.
Yeah,
you do the flying V.
Or like I'm sure any football movie you've seen some crazy formation, some sort of
everybody like
play.
laterals it again.
With Derrick Henry, so Maddie, you've played Madden NFL football. You know the play HB dive. HB dive is halfback dive. It is your running back runs straight forward, up the middle, straight forward. That is the Tennessee Titans playbook with Derrick Henry. It's just like run straight forward.
But and because
he's so impossible to tackle and
so they don't even need to fool anyone.
They don't even
need to think
about
run it. Run it again.
And granted, don't get me wrong, they have a really good offensive line that is like doing a really good job of blocking.
Sure,
but like their plays, their running football, their like scheme of running the football is just like ride Derrick Henry. So somehow they win this game and they have made it to to the AFC Championship, which will be on Sunday. So they will play the Chiefs, who also have looked... The Chiefs, by the way, had an incredible game this past Sunday where they were down 24-0 to the Texans. The Texans scored 24 points in a single quarter and somehow made it 28-24 by halftime. It was unbelievable. It was like one of the craziest football games I've ever seen. So now the Chiefs, coming off that game, will play the Titans, coming off this incredible run of success on Sunday. And man, I have no idea what's going to happen. The Chiefs are favored by 7.5 points. I'm very tempted to take the points on the Titans, but who knows? Man, it's going to be crazy. I wish I would be here next week to see if the Titans, because if the Titans make the Super Bowl, all bets are off. Like, anything can happen, because nobody thought this team would had even the slightest chance of like making it this far. Beating the Patriots, let alone making it this far, knocking out two of like the best teams in the NFL. So that is the exciting storyline in the NFL this week.
That sounds exciting. That makes it me want to watch
It's been fun. Yeah, Derrick Henry is a lot of fun to watch because like you'll see people bounce off of him when they try to tackle him. He's a lot of fun to watch. And the Chiefs have Patrick Mahomes, who you guys must have heard of by now because he's legendary player, just incredible to watch. He's known for these no-look passes where he'll be looking to the right and like fling it to the left, which in basketball is hard enough, but in football is not something that is ever done even. Nice. So he's incredible, and the Chiefs are just super fast and really, really good, and it'll be fascinating to see if the Titans can stop them on Sunday. So, with all that said, Kirk, why don't you give us your music pick of the week, and then we'll say goodbye.
Sure. I feel like everyone is probably feeling a little bit stressed out. There's a lot of stressful things happening in the world right now.
So this That's music fair pick, to say.
This music pick is an antidote to that. This is a band that I only recently discovered through a buddy of mine. They're called Moonchild. They're from Southern California. They're a trio. Man, they're so good. They sound so good. It's like kind of neo soul stuff. I'm really into it. I'm like obsessed with this album. This album has ASMR effects on me when I listen to it on headphones. It's so beautiful. So this is just very straightforward, beautiful tune for people to listen to. This is a tune called The Other Side from their 2019 album Little Ghost. Though all their stuff is very good, this is a clip from The Other Side. Kinds of sounds. I'm like envious of bands that can just make everything sound that good, like with just like the keyboard sounds, the piano sound, that cross stick, like that just that they get on the very tasty. So
yeah, it sounds really good
band. Beautiful. Very good band.
Cool. So that is it for this week's episode, which means that this is goodbye for me for the next few weeks as I go to finish my book and hang out with my child. So I will see you all in mid-February. I should be back.
Yeah, we'll miss you, buddy, but we'll see you. We'll see you when we see you.
It's true. We will.
Yeah, if I come back, I will either be like incredibly stressed out, being like, oh my God, I haven't finished my book. Oh my God, I'm in
no,
so much trouble.
No, that's not going to happen. Don't,
don't even
say
imagine
that.
It.
Or I will be so chill. I'll be like, yeah, it's done.
It's all
I'm
over.
So happy.
Positive
all's
visualization.
Good.
Just visualize that second.
You're
going to
finish the book in the first week, and then you're just going to chill and hang out with
you're the rest be of the time. Again. I'll just be playing video games. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So I will see you guys when I am back.
Yeah, see you in a little bit.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Maddie Myers, Kirk Hamilton, and me, Jason Schreier. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on most popular podcast services, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen and email us at splitscreen@Kotaku.com.
Fuck. fucking ice. What is
I
this
was
shit?
Just
what
thinking
is
that.
What is it, 2015?
Just clickety clack over there.
Jeez. Well, that's why I had it now before we start recording.
Amateur hour.
Hey, look, sometimes I try to time it so the ice will melt by the time that we record. But today I got ice at around like 1-ish, and I thought it would have melted by now, but it's so cold in our office that... Yeah,
wow.
It hasn't.
This is like Outer Wilds. It's like the interloper in Outer Wilds.
Yeah.
You got to time the melting ice.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.